Hello and welcome to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. My name is Natalie Himmelrich.
Today on the podcast, I'm speaking with Sarah Stillman, who suffered preeclampsia and concealed placental abruption, which led to the stillbirth of her first son. Having been sexually assaulted early on in her life in a medical environment, she was very clear about needing to take charge of her medical care to avoid further traumatization. Unfortunately, due to the developments in her pregnancy, it led to emergency care, which then resulted in experiencing even more trauma. Although her son Nathaniel died, Sarah says,
"And wanted to make sure that we were there in his final moments. And all I could say when I look back at the photographs, and I've never been more at peace. I've never been more present. I've never been more, I just want to say myself, than when I was holding him."
We had such a rich conversation that this became a double episode. So make sure you listen to the second part, which is going to be published a week after this, in which we dive much deeper into the topic of pregnancy after loss and how to deal with the trauma of sexual assault. About this week's guest, Sarah is one of Nathaniel's two moms. Yes, he has two moms. Nathaniel is Sarah and Amy's firstborn son, conceived through IVF with a traumatic ending in severe early onset of preeclampsia, placental abruption, emergency C-section and a brief NICU stay, and the death within his mother's arms. Sarah took to grieving, finding out what happened and planning for future pregnancy like a full-time job. And in the midst of the uncertainty and haze of grief, identified resources that helped answer critical questions. In honor of her son, she created whenmybabydied.com, which aims to offer families a centralized resource hub of information and answers for the question no parent ever thought they'd have to find. Sarah is currently pregnant with Nathaniel's sibling, who is expected to be born in April 2023. She lives with her wife, two dogs, and Nathaniel's warrior spirit in central Massachusetts. Make sure to check out Sarah's link, When My Baby Died, which you can find in the show notes. And I hope you enjoy today and next week's episode. I certainly did. So welcome, Sarah. It's so nice to have you here on a podcast. How are you today?
Thanks so much for having me. You know, it's early morning, just getting up. Every day is a little bit of a new day. I am just coming out of February, which was a really challenging month for me, with Nathaniel's first birthday and death date. And it was mixed with a lot of anxiety, actually, around my current pregnancy, where as of today, I'm 31 weeks. Getting through February was really intense. So now that we're in the beginning of March, it feels like we sort of like escaped something. And at the same point, we're getting close to the birth of our next child. And so there's definitely some excitement, anxiety, anticipation. So all of that's wrapped up in today. And then needing to focus and transition to work, which my brain is just so not there right now.
Yeah. Well, so you've given already a little bit of insight into your story about Nathaniel, then also being pregnant, pregnancy after loss. So there's a couple of topics that already stand out. Why don't we start with you telling the listener a little bit about your story of loss and trauma in your life? Maybe there's other things we don't know, and I'm looking forward to hear it from you in your words.
Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, I've told my story in a variety of different ways. I think that there are a few very key milestones. I would not say that my story of like grief and trauma initially, as I associated it with pregnancy and infant loss, really started around Nathaniel. But when I start to think back about all of the things that I think make one's loss unique, right? Because each of us have our own unique story and we bring a lot of history to that. It would start many, many years before. So when I got pregnant with Nathaniel, that was after an early miscarriage that I had had. It was after a lot of, we had done 7 IUIs. I'm in a same-sex couple relationship. So, you know, the standard ways of getting pregnant for us, you know, they look a little bit different. So, we had done, you know, several IUIs that hadn't worked. It was really frustrating. And then...
So let me stop you there. IUI, for people that don't understand,
oh, yes,
can you
I'm
maybe
sorry.
Say a little
bit? It's an intrauterine insemination. So mm-hmm. basically that's where you, instead of putting like, I'll just do the sperm into the vagina, it's sperm into the uterus.
Yeah.
But you're using, typically you use your own egg. So mm-hmm. you, you know, put it around the time that you ovulate. We then moved on to IVF, which is intravitro fertilization, which is sort of like what a lot of people think of, which is where, you know, you retrieve some eggs, you fertilize them, you have an embryo, and then you put that back into whoever's carrying the pregnancy. And for us, that worked the first time with Nathaniel, which was very exciting. But just to go back, I think going into my pregnancy with Nathaniel, my big focus at the time was around dealing with some sexual assault trauma that I had had back in college. And I had never really fully dealt with it in a very deep way. But so my focus when I got pregnant with him was really around how would I handle the medical care that I received to help best handle that trauma. So that was really like my big focus when I went into my pregnancy with him. It became actually quite challenging early on because I ended up having about 8 weeks in, I had like an appendicitis attack and had to get my appendix removed. Like it was just like, it was a crazy pregnancy.
While you were pregnant?
I was pregnant. And,
oh, wow.
You know, we were rushed to the hospital and the whole thing, you know, the whole thing. And luckily, like, I was okay. Nathaniel's pregnancy continued. And we thought everything was fine. We were like, this is crazy, but at least everything's fine.
So let me get that straight. So you had an appendicitis. So that's an operation on the body while the body's pregnant.
Exactly.
Yeah, so... You know, from a trauma perspective, every operation, this is an assault to the body.
Yeah.
If you have an operation, I mean, even though the operation might be life-saving, on a physical level, it's still trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just to remember that as well, you know, now the thing is the way we experience this and experience it and whether it has then a traumatic effect of us long-term, that's a different thing. But just for people listening as well, that to know that an operation, the way it is affecting the body is traumatic and then can also be experienced as traumatic sometimes or not.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the other piece that was, you know, this was so hard about the experience was that, you know, I was early on, I was about 8 weeks and the doctors and the medical sort of environment was like, well, you're really early on. It was almost like, if you lose the baby, you lose, like the baby dies, like it doesn't really matter, you know? And for me, that was, you know, absolutely not a possibility, you know, like I was really, really focused on making sure that, you know, whatever medications they gave me, everything, like that the embryo, the fetus would be okay. And, you know, I healed relatively quickly and we sort of continued to move on through the weeks of pregnancy. And everything I thought was going really well. You know, we had our anatomy scan, we had some additional scans because I had had this operation. We got to have some additional ultrasounds. And everything seemed to be moving along swimmingly until about 26 weeks. And in retrospect, that's not true. In retrospect, I had had many, many early signs of things that were going quite awry with my body as it related to preeclampsia, which is ultimately, at 26 weeks, we found out Nathaniel was severely growth restricted, did another growth ultrasound a couple weeks later. It was confirmed that it was even worse. And so we were quickly escalated from this care model. I had had a midwife. I really wanted a natural birth where, you know, I could be in a tub and I would have no medication. And, you know, that was really what I had wanted initially, as I was describing, for the sort of experience of like healing my body through my previous trauma and hopefully having it be sort of this, you know, empowering experience. And that was all quickly ripped away. Not that I would admit that to myself, but it was ripped away as we were escalated from sort of our midwifery care to a maternal fetal medicine focus, where we were informed that, you know, the baby was severely growth restricted and that I would likely develop severe preeclampsia. And I was like, that's not going to happen. I was in like deep, deep denial. Mm-hmm. And it did. I shouldn't have been necessarily surprised. When I look back at pictures now, you know, Amy and I have, who is my wife, we've been really diligent about like taking photographs of like my hands and my feet and my face to compare what happened last time with my pregnancy this time, and to sort of say like, am I getting more swollen than I was, you know, because that was one of the first signs I had put on by the end of my pregnancy, probably close to 25 or 30 pounds of water weight. And it had would just come on in these like spurts. Ultimately, you know, I was admitted to the hospital, my blood pressure spiked, I developed severe preeclampsia within days of sort of this doctor warning me. And I was admitted to the hospital where I was not a great patient. I was really angry that I was there. I was really frustrated that I wasn't going to likely get the birth experience that I wanted. I was taken away from sort of wanting to have the sort of experience that I had expected. And then found out, you know, they said, you know, we're going to try to deliver Nathaniel at, you know, 34 weeks. So we didn't know it was a boy at the time. And, you know, I was 31, 32 weeks. And then we didn't make it that far. You know, I woke up on the morning of February 18th. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was having like severe belly pain. My belly was really, really hard. I went to the bathroom. I really wasn't feeling well. I knew something was wrong.
That was all the while when you were in hospital, right?
I was in the hospital. I'd been there for about almost 2 weeks at this point. You know, I had gone to bed the night before, frustrated at the nurse that came in, you know, a little later than I had wanted her to, because I'd wanted to go to sleep early. And, you know, she had done the Doppler and he was fine. And, you know, we chatted a little bit and then I went to bed and I woke up and knew something was wrong. And I didn't want to, you know, pull the red emergency thing that we have here in the U.S. that's like makes people come running. So I was like, no, I'll just call the nurse on like the regular system. So, you know, I ended up doing that. And I said, I think something's wrong. And, you know, it took them a little while to get in there, and they're like, what's going on? And I was like, I really don't feel well. And then I guess all of a sudden my blood pressure like just tanked. And I almost passed out, and they got me onto the bed, and, then they started to try to find the baby's heartbeat, and they couldn't. And they quickly realized that the situation was much more pressing than I think anyone had realized, you know, so they brought in a bedside ultrasound. It was like, you know, pitch black in my room. And I was like, I think I should probably call my wife. So I'm like trying to get my wife on the phone, you know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. She's not answering. All the meanwhile, they're then saying they found the baby's heartbeat, but it was at 50 beats per minute. And I was like, that's not good. And they said, we're going to the operating room now. And so as I was being wheeled out, I had this final stroke of thought to call my sister. My wife was staying at my parents' house. My sister lives with my parents. And I said, and I called her and she answered. And I said, there's something wrong with the baby. I'm going to get a C-section. You need to get me here. And then I was wheeled off to the operating room. You know, and I remember lying on the operating table, you know, there was just so many people and like hands were going everywhere. And I just remember thinking to myself, this is going to be traumatic. This is the trauma that I really wanted to have avoided. And thinking to myself, I'm going to have to do some work on this when all of this is over. You know, I had like people's hands between my legs, and I was just like, it was, and I just needed to like go to a place that would just, you know, be sort of calm. And right before I went under, we had this, I had a fellow who was going to ultimately do the surgery because she was on call. And I will never forget her words because it was really shocking. They were quite shocking. She said, you know, your baby doesn't have a heartbeat anymore, is unlikely to survive. What do you want to do? You know, and I was already like strapped down to this operating table. And I mean, it was seemed like such an absurd question, which I, it was then confirmed by other doctors that it was an absurd question to sort of ask someone. And I said, save my baby. And that was the last thing I remembered. And then I woke up, not knowing what had happened. You know, I was hooked up to, I guess my blood pressure had spiked when I was on the operating table. And so there was like a lot of craziness that had happened, but I had had a total concealed placental abruption, which is basically where the placenta completely comes away from the uterine wall. Mm-hmm. And it's called concealed because I had no bleeding.
Oh, okay.
So those types of placental abruptions are extremely, extremely rare. Placental abruptions in general are very rare. They're like, but like no more than like 2-3%. And then
is that connected to preeclampsia or not?
It is connected to preeclampsia, which I had no idea.
Okay, me neither. So that's fine. Yeah.
I found out later. But it tends to be the most extreme sort of result of a very sick placenta, basically. Placental abruptions can also happen like due to trauma of the stomach. So like sometimes like if you're in a car accident, for example, like a bad car accident, that can happen. But there have been more and more cases where it's really connected to the arteries and the veins and whatever, the connection pieces of the placenta to the uterus. And, you know, the trauma and grief really just continue, right? So learning that Nathaniel had been without oxygen for almost 18 minutes, it had taken them 5 more minutes to revive him once he was out of my uterus, and they had been able to revive him, which was incredible. And I do associate that with the amazing care that was offered at the hospital, you know, to through our NICU. And, you know, he had so many issues that we like came to learn about. But that, you know, ultimately waking up and realizing he was really sick, and we were going to go, ended up going home without our baby, which was not even a possibility to me like 12 hours before. I didn't even know that that was like, that wasn't even like a known possibility. And so then we sort of entered this new world of the NICU, of being with a baby that had severe, I'm not even sure that he would have been able to ever leave the NICU given some of the issues he had. And then we entered the space of at what point for us do we take our baby off of these supports? And what do we do? How does that look like? Because, you know, I think for many of us, you know, Nathaniel was sort of my firstborn. I think of him that way. You know, we had not even considered the way that we want to go, like our end of life care, let alone think about it for your child.
Exactly.
And so that's really where that trauma and grief really sit. And then trying to figure out what is life after, you know, the knowing that you're going to experience loss and then actually experiencing it. And you don't just, and there's so many secondary losses too. So, you know, not just the loss of the physical being, but the loss of who you thought you were going to be, the future life, who you were before. So it was a real, for lack of a better term, a real shit show. When we walked, you know, it was terrible in the hospital, and got even worse when we left. And so that's sort of the place where I left, where I would sort of say, like, I just became seated in this new grief and trauma that, for me, to be honest, nothing had ever compared to it. And it was truly like a whole new world that I had to work through.
When you said you left the hospital and it got worse for you?
So I think it got worse in so far as emotionally and mentally, you're still sort of so stuck in the shock of it all. And then we stayed at my parents' house for a couple of weeks because I needed to be monitored for my preeclampsia and follow up and things like that. So like health wise, I was still sort of in a tricky spot. So that was hard, but it was more the emotional piece of like, what does life actually look like? And sort of, you know, you're still in that shock, but it's not the immediate, you know, shock of it all. And just these realization waves that would just come over you and trying to figure out this new world and this new life. And it was incredibly overwhelming. You know, I just remember my wife talks about it too, you know, crying, and making a sound that, you know, she's like, I had never heard a human make that noise before. You know, that the guttural screams.
Yeah, I actually just, in preparation for the webinar that is coming up this week, I was looking through some images of my time with the girls, my birth. And there was actually a video that my sister took at the time where I was holding Maya. And we had disconnected her from life support at that point. She was still moving and she was looking at me. And I was taking it all in. And there was this moment where it just a wave overtook me. And I think my sister got scared or shocked because of what unfolded, and she stopped filming. But actually, I think it's good. It was good for me to rewatch that, to remember how this was, because, you know, 11 years later, I'm in a different place. And still, as you said before, this is the most intense that I've ever felt, the most intense thing that I went through. And I think for us talking here means whether we are 11 years or less, doesn't really matter. But the fact that we are here talking about it means we've survived and we are made to survive this is not easy, but neither is giving birth, right?
Right.
I mean, I had a C-section, so I cannot really speak with that, but still, giving birth is a big thing. So I also don't want to compare having your child die or someone, the loved one die with the birth of a child, because at the end of giving birth, you have something in most cases, hopefully. With the death, you don't. But beside the point, we are given this life. And at the end of life, there is death. That's a given. We're just living life in a way of disillusionment that it's not. And actually, as also preparation for the webinar, I read a very interesting article, because I was looking at why do we have such a death avoidance society, as I call it, or as it's called. And actually, in fact, it is built in the brain to avoid thoughts of our own demise. And if we are faced with that, we, like the brain automatically thinks this is not probable. And when I read that, this is from a university, so it's not just someone's opinion, I thought, wow, that's interesting. So actually we're built to not look at that or not be prepared for that option. But we, as survivors of having experienced loss, we know that this is not just a distant probability. It's actually, we have been so close with death that we know this is it. This is part of this as well.
Yeah. I mean, I've been talking with a newly bereaved mom who also had to make the decision to take her daughter off of her supports, and just talking about the impact that, you know, as you had mentioned with Maya, like holding a body that is, you know, will die, and watching that process happen. It's life changing.
I don't know how it was for you, and maybe you talk about it, but for me, interestingly, you know, looking back to that moment, I mean, I can't go back into how it was in that moment, but I have certain memories. And one of the memories that I have is the honor that I felt having just given birth. And then standing at the other side of this window, which I called one door is birth, one door is death. Mm-hmm. And I get goosebumps when I talk about this, because I felt such an honor to be allowed to be present for my daughter in this. And still now when I think about it, it was this huge honor. At the same time, I was also a mother who had just given birth to twins. And I thought, this is not okay. This is not as spiritually okay as one part of me thought, and the other part of the mother just said, no, I don't want this. Yeah. This is not what this was meant to be.
Yeah, I think I personally wouldn't have said the word honor. Like, that was not necessarily what I was feeling, but I wouldn't have wanted it any other way.
Mm.
You know, we made the intentional decision to make sure that I was still admitted to the hospital and that we could have some modicum of control, right, over how comfortable we could potentially make him, and wanted to make sure that we were there in his final moments. And all I can say when I look back at the photographs, that I've never been more at peace. I've never been more present. I've never been more, I just want to say it myself, than when I was holding him.
Hmm.
And, you know, he would be snuggled into me. And, you know, watching his body die and like disintegrate was our like horrors that like we will always remember.
Mm.
But the beauty of being able to be a family together while he was still physically earthside are moments that I will always, always cherish.
Mm.
And as sad as I am post, you know, after he died, in those moments, I didn't cry. I was just so there, just so filled with love. And you can look at the pictures. I'm smiling in some of them, and it's not a fake smile. It's like a true, genuine happiness to finally have my baby in my arms. So, you know, I think back to those moments, and I cherish those pictures. You know, and now I'm over a year out, and it's hard. I don't remember what his body felt like. I don't remember what he smelled like anymore. So I only have those pictures. I'm grateful to the nurses who put together sort of this like memory, these memory items for us of like of his handprints, of his footprints. They took clippings of his hair. You know, all of these things that I didn't even think of in the moment.
Yeah, you don't have to.
You know, I cherish each of those items.
So you just said I've been a little bit more than a year. And how did you deal with your grief and loss in that year?
When I left the hospital, and I was, you know, in those early weeks, I'm not sure how I survived, to be honest. But I do remember thinking, I have all of this energy, I have all of this mothering that I want to do. And so initially I threw it into the initial like mothering of his memory. So making sure that, you know, we planned a memorial service for him. I got photos made of him. We had photos. I, you know, printed them. I framed them. You know, we finally got home. I hung all these photographs up, like just ensuring that he was here in as many ways as possible. The other piece that I did early on, and I'm so grateful that I did, was that I started reading a ton of books on grief, especially child loss. And what I walked away with from some of those books early on was, if I am going to survive this, I have to grieve and grieve well, and make sure that I have a space for that. And so part of figuring out what that meant for me was getting a grief therapist, you know, working through the birth trauma, making sure that my wife and I were initially in couples counseling to make sure that we were, you know, on the same page while we were grieving. And slowly just trying to make sure that I was trying to find places and spaces for support. And I feel really lucky that, you know, all of this, like I said, this mothering energy I put into mothering my grief.
That's right.
Mothering his memory. And over the last year, it's been incredibly healing. You know, and healing will be a forever journey. But by about 6 months, I felt like I had started to figure out this sort of new Sarah. I had been able to sort of disconnect from these other pieces of myself. Sometimes it was loss of relationships. Sometimes it was just the disappearance of bad habits, right? And so by about 6 months, I really came and I paused and I was like, oh, I'm a very different person than I was 6 months ago. And that's all due to Nathaniel. And I think in the last, you know, the second 6 months or so, now it's been a little bit more than that, has really been learning more about like who this new person is, setting intentions, and working to have those intentions become a reality. And part of that is, you know, my current pregnancy, But a lot of it is, how am I approaching my marriage? How am I approaching my relationships? How am I approaching my professional life? And I see Nathaniel integrated and at the root cause of all of that.
Hey, wait, don't leave yet. So Sarah has more to say, and Nathaniel's story doesn't end here. Make sure to listen to the next episode coming out in a week. Now, if it's already published, you can just hop along to episode number 35 and continue listening.
Thanks for listening to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. If you'd like to be updated on future episodes, please subscribe to my newsletter on nataliehimmelrich.com. If you need grief support, please contact me for a 30 minutes free discovery session. How to Deal with Grief and Trauma is produced and edited by me, Natalie Himmelrich. To support this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. And remember to keep reading. I promise it will get easier.